This week's episode of the FitCast features music by Carissa's World titled Die. Not the most uplifting title, but the song is pretty awesome. You can check them out at subpop.com. And don't forget, you can download this song and all the other Sub Pop songs for free at subpop.com. This week's episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 185. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and again, I'm by myself right now, but we have myself, Jonathan Fass, Mike Robertson coming up in just a few moments. Just a couple quick things. Obviously, we didn't get to do the whole podcast that we wanted to this week. Again, you know, schedules are all over the place. We're doing the best that we can with the time that we have. So we have like an hour and a half interview with Mike Robertson where we talk about tons of stuff. I'm talking knees, hips, rehab, the state of the fitness industry. Like we have a discussion towards the end where we just talk about kind of the certification process, you know, if the how the whole fitness world should be governed, if it should be at all, and we kind of get in a little bit of an argument, but I think you guys are really going to like it. And the best part is, after you listen to it, I want to get some listener feedback. I'll mention it later in the show, but we want to get a little bit of listener feedback every single week in the show. The first week's version that we're going to have is, you know, what do you do to stick with your training or your diet? We got a couple people that called in this past week, so we're going to run those first, and then we're going to go into the interview. I hope you guys like it. So, you know, the more participation, the better. The more we get to, you know, kind of see where you're coming from, and it helps us, you know, not necessarily modify the show, but, you know, shape the show so it's going to be right for you guys out there. So please participate, call in, leave a voicemail. Let us know what you think, all right? You can also send an MP3 to questions@thefitcast.com. I mean, there's tons of different ways to record audio now, so hopefully we can figure some way to get you going on that. So that's it. That's all I'm going to mention for right now. Hope you guys enjoy the show. I know I did today. It was very awesome. So check it out. First, listener feedback. Let's listen to what people had to say. All right, guys, I'm going to be honest. We only got one person who called in. One person, guys. Come on. We need you guys to call in 978-633-3488 or the easier to remember 775-45-FITCAST. And let us know. Guys, I want some listener feedback. I want you to call in. Yeah, you out there who's listening with your headphones on the way to work. I want you to call in and tell us what you think. You guys have opinions that count as well. So please, send your responses. But here's a great one. Here it comes.
Hi, Kevin. My name is Mindy Anderson, and I'm from Chicago. I was calling in regards to the question you had asked, what do I do to stay on track with my fitness goals? I actually love listening to the podcast every morning on my way to work. I listen to it or on my long cardio day, so keep up the great work. We really are enjoying that out here. A little bit about me, I'm a fitness director at a retirement village, and the FitCast is such a help because I oversee more than 230 programs with residents and staff and family members. I also teach classes and do nutrition, so all of those tips from you and Lee and John really help. I also am a figure competitor with the NPC, so I really enjoyed the podcast with the NPC, with the figure competitor girl. It was great a while back. And what I do is I actually hired a coach to keep me on track with my fitness goals all year round. So I report to her every 2 weeks, and just that accountability really, really helps. So that's what I do. Thank you so much for all that you do, and we'll keep listening. Bye-bye.
See, that's what I'm talking about. That's some listener feedback. We want some more from you guys. So again, send them in for this week's question. Or, you know what, if you have one that is for that question, you know, what do you do to stick to your fitness and nutrition goals, or, you know, whatnot? What keeps you motivated? All right, send in those responses. 775-45-FITCAST. You can also send them in to questions@thefitcast.com in a digital audio file. And, you know, let's see what you have to say for next week. I expect a little bit more, right? A little bit more from you guys. So, anyways, here is the interview with Mike Robertson. Jonathan Fass and I were delighted to have him on the show. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. Great, phenomenal discussion at the end. You guys are going to come away with a ton of stuff, including, you know, the whole controversy, single leg versus double leg. It's all coming up right now. All right, it's bright and early on Sunday morning, and I am with Jonathan Fass and Mike Robertson. Mike, who we've had on a couple times in the past, you may know. And if you haven't already, please check out his website, robertsontrainingsystems.com, his fantastic In the Trenches podcast, which, again, if you haven't already, check it out. What are you doing? Mike, I got to see you a couple of weeks ago at Perform Better in Chicago, but now I get to talk to you through Skype, which is almost as magical. How you doing?
Yes, it's amazing. Kevin, I'm doing well, man. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. We're here bright and early thanks to Jonathan Fass and his International Man of Mystery time zone issues. So thank you, John.
No problem, bud.
I didn't break any rules by saying that, did I?
I don't think so.
All right, awesome. Well, we have a fantastic interview. You probably have already heard part of the show, which we're going to record in a little bit. That's in the future. But I love
to the future, in fact.
I just pre-ordered that on Blu-ray. It's coming out in Blu-ray in like a couple months.
Sweet.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty awesome. And so anyways, we have a bunch of questions for Mike. And, you know, it's always great to have Mike on the show because he is one of the guys out there, you know, just like his podcast. He's in the trenches. He is at his facility pretty much every day of the week doing the stuff that he's telling everyone else to do. So this is really always improving on things and, you know, seeing new things that can help us out there that are trainers, but also you guys out there who may just be the weekend warriors who want to just go at it and not hurt yourself, which is a big deal. And considering how many questions we get into the mailbag saying, ow, this hurts, and my knees and my hips and et cetera, et cetera, that's why we have guys like Mike on. So, you know, again, Mike, first off, I mean, what's been going on? I mean, we haven't talked to you, and I feel like, you know, 6 months, 8 months, something like that?
I think it might have been a year, man.
Wow.
Honestly, because I think last time was before preseason of last year's football, and we talked about
you
know, the Colts and the Giants and the Pats and all that stuff, and we did get great feedback on that, just FYI. Amazing off topic on our part. But, you know, same old, really, just trying to grow our gym, staying busy with that. I'm getting ready to work on a chapter. The IYCA is actually getting ready to release a like high school strength and conditioning program. Hopefully I can say all this. If not, I'm in big trouble. But
well, they just added me as a friend on Twitter, so I think they'll be cool with it.
I hope so. But, you know, just to kind of cultivate a better strength and conditioning setting for high school athletes, because there's obviously, if you guys have seen high school strength and conditioning programs, they pretty much suck. Mm. So they're trying to standardize that, make it similar to the CSCS, only better and actually a little bit more usable. So I've got to work on that here at the end of this month. And then, you know, just same old stuff, man. I always say world domination, but it's really just more like Indianapolis / internet domination. So that's what I got going on right now.
It's the World Wide Web, though. It's still applicable.
The interwebs. As soon as I own the interwebs, game over.
We are always having new listeners join the show, and if they haven't you know, heard any of your interviews in the past, things like that, like what kind of athletes are you generally dealing with, or do you deal with a lot of the general population as well?
You know, the gym population is really about 50-50, and it's about 50% what I would call like physique enhancement. That could be muscle gain, fat loss, weight loss, that sort of thing. So that's more your pure general population. And then on the other side, we're getting more and more athletes. And when I say athletes, it's mostly middle and high school age kids, anywhere from 11 to 18, 19 years old. And I mean, we're not like Eric, where we're very niche. You know, he's got obviously baseball down to a T. We're a little bit more broad in our focus. So we've got baseball, basketball, football, soccer. We got some hockey players. I mean, it's kind of all over the board, but it suits my ADD personality quite well because, you know, I can't focus on one thing for much longer than a day and a half. So it helps having all these different kids in there, and you just get a much better understanding of, you know, how athletes really train these days. And, you know, it's not like it was 10, 15 years ago when I was a kid. So just interesting, to say the least.
Very cool. So let's get into the questions that we got from the listeners, and we'll kind of see where it goes. If people don't know, a lot of this stuff is going to be in regards to knees. You know, Mike's been known for bulletproof knees, and also he's got a new product out there called the Single Leg Solution, which is really big. And that's one of the first things that I want to kind of hit on is I mean, I don't want to steal a lot of your talk from Chicago, but
sure.
One of the great discussions that you brought up was single leg versus double leg, and kind of, you know, I don't know if it's like a controversy that's going on in the industry, but, you know, people are definitely talking about it. And, you know, what are your feelings on it?
You know, it's interesting because I always talk about when I got in the industry like 10 years ago, I think that's when like the whole single leg movement kind of got started. But if you look back 20, 30 years ago, to kind of the strength and conditioning roots and the development of strength and conditioning programs, it was very bilateral dominant. You had a lot of like former power lifters or Olympic lifters that naturally kind of became strength coaches. So tons of guys were always including, you know, squats and deadlifts and power cleans and snatches in the programming. And I think over time, you see guys like a Mike Boyle or a Vern Gambetta and these guys that are talking about, you know, if you train athletes, maybe improving your powerlifting total or your Olympic lifting total isn't the best thing to creating a well-rounded athlete. So a lot of these guys came along and said, look, maybe we should be spending more time on one leg. And, you know, I think I wrote an article in 03 or 04 for T-Muscle called Single Leg Supplements, and just kind of outlining even bodybuilders should be incorporating some single leg work. But I think what you've seen in the last year or two is almost this overcorrection to where we've gone away from a lot of double leg lifts. And you'll see a lot of programs now where it's totally unilateral. And again, while I see the benefits and there are pros and cons to both styles of lifting, whether it's two legs or one leg, but when you have this overcorrection and you get rid of all double leg lifts, you lose some of the benefits. And the benefits of double leg lifting at the end of the day are strength and power development. So if you especially work with athletes, you know, strength and power development is something that's pretty important. Another concept that a lot of people aren't talking about is that ability to absorb and produce force effectively. When we talk about deceleration and how important deceleration is, that's one of the benefits of two-leg lifting. The forces involved are a lot more specific to sports than maybe what you would see on one leg. Now, that's not to say that single-leg lifting or unilateral lifting isn't important, because if you think about split squats, for example, you get a lot of extension and mobility through your back leg hip. You get a ton of stabilizer activation, which is important because a lot of people have poor not only like hip and pelvic stability, but total body stability as well. So I guess the biggest take-home issue that I always try and explain to people, it's not an either-or situation. It's not black and white where it's just do double leg lifts or just do single leg lifts. I think they're both important. They both have a role in a program, but at the same time, you know, we can't exclude anything. We have to look at the needs and goals of our specific client base and then kind of develop programming from there.
John, I'm really, I mean, it kind of stinks that you weren't able to come out to the seminar, but, you know, really interesting stuff. And it was one of the things that definitely got people talking at the end of the presentation as well. So I think it's something that's going to be really interesting to watch over the next couple of years, where, you know, where things are going to kind of fall. And maybe it is so a little bit of each.
Yeah, I think so anyway. But one man's opinion, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah. But that's what it's all about.
You know, and I think, I mean, it's always that way. It's like you see these trends, and what are trends? There are ideas that are taken to this like bastardized level of this is the way to do it. And, you know, an idea is only as good as the total integration into what you're doing, because otherwise it's pointless. You know, there's unless you're a specific athlete working on a very specific type of, you know, need, then one size does not typically fit all. And I think that's a great point. So you take something that has a lot of value, like single leg training, and then you just make it that's all I do, and that's all I do forever, then it kind of loses a lot of these other qualities that Mike just referred to. And it you know, it's just one of those things where I think a lot of new trainers also kind of fall into that subject area, you know, where it's like this is the first thing they're kind of introduced to as a new, you know, professional or as a new lifter or whatever, and it works for them, and this is all they know. And I think when you've had a little bit of experience, you start to be able to take that step back and go, but, you know, 5-10 years ago, I was doing some stuff that was pretty cool too. And you start to reintegrate, you start to reintroduce, and you start to really not only build that toolbox, but actually start to use the tools that are in it, you know?
Yeah, it's a great point. And it just comes back to, especially when you're young and impressionable, you know, Mike always talks about like the cook versus the chef. Or I don't know if I remember the exact analogy, but, you know, when it's early on, you know, you kind of got to take other people's word for it. But as you get older and you've got a little bit better critical thinking skills, you can really start to figure out what's my philosophy, what fits into, you know, what I believe to be true and all that stuff. And then you can kind of develop your own programming and your own systems from there. But it's hard early on. We've got so many young trainers that are getting into the industry and they're getting, you know, continuing education. They're going to perform better in all these great events. But at the same time, you know, that's part of the problem with young trainers. They only know so much, but everybody's getting elevated to a higher status quicker and quicker because of the internet. You know, immediately somebody could have a YouTube page with 300 videos, but they're a 23-year-old kid and they've only trained people for a year.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's just this, the whole industry is changing. And when you right. start to look at it like that, like, hey, how much credibility does this person have? I mean, Mike's been in the industry 27, 28 years now. So, you know, chances are I'm going to listen to him over the guy that's got 1,000 YouTube videos on his site. But it's hard for a lot of people to differentiate who really are experts these days just because there's so many people out there and so many different opinions.
Yeah.
Mike, I mean, how did you feel the response was at the seminar? Did you feel like it, you know, it went over pretty well? And what kind of general feelings were you getting from where people stood?
You know, I think I got fantastic feedback. I had numerous people either come up to me or email me or, you know, the ever popular Facebook friend me afterwards and, you know, say something like, hey, great presentation. You know, I learned a lot. It's always hard. And I never know because sometimes I can't tell if people are just thinking, but I'm a little bit more cerebral than a lot of the guys that you find on the Perform Better circuit. You know, and I said this in the Q&A on Saturday. There are guys like BJ Gadur and Todd Durkin. I mean, they've got so much energy and so much passion. And you go into a hands-on with them and, you know, they get you through a great workout. You're sweating. You feel great. You're motivated. Then you come to mine, you know, whatever, 9:15 Sunday morning. You've been learning for 2 days straight. You've been boozing for 2 days straight. And here I am talking about how to perform your split squat. You know what I mean? So it's stuff that I think people need to learn. It's stuff that, you know, a lot of people take for granted and they think, oh, I know how to coach a lunge. But when you really break it down, you start to look at all the intricacies of a lift. It's like, hey, there's a lot of stuff I can work on here. There's a lot of stuff I can learn about how my clients move. So I always try and take it with a grain of salt. And, you know, by Sunday, you're not going to get like this overwhelming, like people jumping up and down type feedback, like, oh, this is awesome. But at the same time, I think the feedback that I got was fantastic. People learned a lot of things. And if they came in and they listened to both the lecture and the hands-on, I feel like they're going to be a lot better prepared to coach and train their clients and athletes. So pretty good feedback overall. I was very happy with it. So no complaints on my part.
And John, as we continue, please ever, you know, if you need to, feel free to jump in and ask follow-ups or anything like that.
Well, thanks, Kevin.
I mean, I don't know if this is your first time or not.
Thanks, Kevin.
That sounded really creepy. All right.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Hear that, Mike? Kevin, trust me.
He's so polite.
Hey, we got a fantastic question from Jessica. She asks, I have a question about my hip. When I squat, deadlift, and sometimes just try to stand up, my right hip hurts in the front. I have tried stretching my hip flexor, but I keep having pain at the bottom of my squat and deadlift. It doesn't hurt when I stretch it, so is there something else I need to try? I have a desk job, so I try to do lots of mobility stuff. We do a dynamic warm-up before each workout, stretch and foam roll regularly. We have assess and correct, so there are areas I need, we have assessing, correct? So are there areas I need to focus on in that? My husband also has a question for Mike. What's up with your RSS feed? It shows up all weird on my Google Reader. Also, In the Trenches is having iTunes issues. Thanks for putting on a great show. I'm glad Faz has more time to post on Facebook now. Oh, this is great for John, too. I love the articles he's been posting. Thanks. That's Jessica from Apex, North Carolina. So,
Jessica, first off, thanks for the question. I'll answer your husband's question first. RSS feed, yes. And I don't want to sound rude at all about this because I appreciate people telling me this, but it's been an issue since April. And so actually today, as of the day that we're recording this, July whatever, 11th, 10th, I don't know what day it is, I'm getting an entirely new website, like, updated. So my RSS feed should be fixed. Exactly. My iTunes feed should be fixed. If it is not after today, then, you know, my web guy has promised he's going to take care of it. But it's been an ongoing issue, and we're working on fixing that. So thank you for letting me know. What?
Does that count as, like, a world premiere announcement? Did we just get the scoop?
World
premiere. You guys do. It's like The Onion right here.
We got my favorite source of information.
The Onion, dude. If you're on The Onion or The Smoking Gun or whatever it is, yeah.
Amazing.
Yes, so it should be up by the end of the day. That's what my web guy told me. And it's going to be sexy, like John.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to answer your question, Jessica, and I would love to hear John's feedback as well, because I think he might be onto the same track as me. Right hip. If we start looking at how a lot of people move, I would say you're probably doing all the wrong things for your hip. A lot of times you'll see anterior hip impingements on the right side. For lack of a better term, people have a hard time getting off of their right hip. So if I took a picture of you, chances are you would be shifted to the right, which would put your right hip in this kind of compensated internal rotation pattern. And so you're going to have an impingement because basically your big muscles, like your glutes, especially the external rotation fibers of your glutes, are going to be long and weak. So essentially, you're constantly going to be in this internally rotated or almost impinged type of position. So when you go down deeper and deeper, your glutes can't really get you in the right position and you have pain. So what I would really try and work on for you, work on your external rotation for your right hip. You can look at exercises such as, you know, clamshells. We've been doing, you know, side-lying hip abductions. I think we call them like hip wall slides on Assess and Correct. But anything where we can get a pure hip either abduction or external rotation pre-workout is going to make a big difference. What I would watch there, a lot of people will compensate with like a lateral bend or a side or a lateral flexion. So what you may need to do is if you're doing that exercise, take a towel roll or something, place it basically on your side so you can't rotate or side bend through your lumbar spine, and then kind of groove that pattern from there. One of the exercises I've been using a lot for that, and I think this is on my YouTube page, I'm not sure, but I just call it a low to high cable chop. So essentially, all it is like a triplanar hip abduction, hip external rotation exercise. And Kevin, I'll try and send you a link to that if you want to put it in the show notes, because a lot of times what I'll do is I'll start with the basic low-level exercises on the ground, and then I will give them more loaded type of exercises from there. But chances are you may have like a hip impingement, so you can stretch and do all that stuff all you want. You don't need more flexibility or more mobility. What you need is more strength in your hip abductors and hip external rotators. Faz, do you see that more on the right side than the left?
Mike, you had me at anterior hip impingement.
Yes.
You know, I probably, now that you mention it, you know, I probably do. Because I'm trying to think of like the last couple of cases where I had a suspected anterior femoral acetabular hip impingement.
Yes.
You know, you're probably right. It probably was. And I will say one thing though that I will add. You said that mobility is not an issue. Sometimes it is, but it's capsular mobility.
Yes.
But that because that's the suspected mechanism of how this occurs. We don't know why anterior impingements occur yet, although there is suggestion that they're very similar, like shoulder impingements, where we have different forms of the cam form, it's called, which is the way that the hip is actually shaped.
Yeah.
It's a cam and pincer is the way that it's described. So we believe that that's kind of similar to when we describe the shoulder as having like a type 1, type 2, type 3. Same sort of thing happens in the hip. And if you think about it, it sort of makes sense, because if we walked around on hands and feet still, they'd basically be two of the same sort of things. So the only thing that I would add is that that capsular mobility can be an issue, and it's usually a posterior capsule stiffness that occurs. Whether or not that occurs because there was impingement, or maybe that stiffness causes the impingement, we don't really know. But generally speaking, if that's what we suspect, then we make a list of the impairments like Mike suggested, and a lot of times it's that strength imbalance, it's the weakness of the extensors, just like Mike said. Interestingly enough, there's not a whole lot of evidence-based practice in terms of how we deal with it. So for the time being, it's still an issue of make a list of those impairments and then treat them. It's probably something that you should see someone for, not necessarily try to fix it, although I don't think that anything that Mike said is wrong, because that's basically what you would do given a you know, quote-unquote typical anterior hip pain sort of treatment. But it may be worth your while just to make sure, because there are also other things that can cause that kind of pain, including labral tears, which are associated with anterior impingements. They believe that that prolonged anterior impingement may down the road lead to labral tears. And that's the kind of thing that like A-Rod had last year. He had surgery for labral repair. So it's something that you don't really want to mess with. But if it's recent enough and you can give it like a week or two of that type of strengthening and see if there's anything that improves, then at least you're headed down the right direction. But I still think something like that deserves someone taking a look at.
Thanks for the question, Jessica.
Oh, and thanks for enjoying my Facebook.
Yeah. I don't know about all that, but whatever.
Dude, I read so much now. It's awesome. And I just post up everything on Facebook. Since I'm too lazy to update my blog, I just post like constant articles, and it's fun.
I got some good stuff for you when we're all done. I got something you need
sweet.
To check out. You'll
sweet.
Like it.
John, maybe you should write like a blog post.
Maybe you should mind your own beeswax.
Let's not get all crazy here, Kevin. Come
yes,
on.
Seriously, homie.
When it comes to actual work and typing.
Right. That's a little bit beyond my capabilities. I only talk.
All right. All right. And John, also the way the interview process works with two hosts is that we alternate the questions. So let's make sure that happens from now on. Thank you.
Does that mean that when I'm reading the question, you'll shut up?
I'm going to mute my mic because I might go to the bathroom, John.
I purchased Assess and Correct a few months ago, and it has been extremely useful. So thanks for a great product. Still, one issue I have not been able to improve much with is my hip internal rotation. I have really good external rotation, but when testing internal rotation seated, I can get only a few degrees of motion. When testing prone, I get over 20 degrees, so I guess this points to having a muscular issue. The problem is that the early progressions feel really uncomfortable, almost painful in my knees. Could having knock knees contribute to this? Could you provide any alternative exercises for increasing hip internal rotation? If there is time for a second question, could you talk a little bit about knock knees? I have previously understood that if you have knock knees, you're pretty much stuck with them for the rest of your life. However, Assess and Correct contains some exercises for them, but the intent of them is left a bit unclear. Are they just for addressing usual issues associated with knock knees, or can one expect some kind of other improvements? Thanks for your time. And that's PASI, P-A-S-I, PASI, PASI. Sorry if I did not pronounce that. What do you think, Mike?
PASI, PASI. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that either. Thanks, John. But
yeah, sorry.
Here is my thought process, and I can answer both your questions with one answer, because what I'm thinking is you probably don't have a lot of actual internal rotation mobility because your hips are already internally rotated. So if I took a picture of you from the front and your knock-kneed, chances are you already are in a position of internal rotation. So when you go to test it, you don't have a lot more range because you're already past neutral. So essentially, you don't necessarily probably need more internal rotation. What you actually need is more external rotation strength. Not only is that going to help get you back to neutral, So whenever you're in neutral, you're going to test better as far as your internal and external rotation mobility, but that's also going to help correct that knock knee alignment. So it's one of those things where it's a total body fix, because a lot of times too, if you're in a position of knock knees or internal rotation at your hip, your pelvis is anteriorly rotated too. So you're going to need, you know, all the basic stuff. I'm assuming you're a female, so you're going to need like the lower ab strength and the external oblique strength to try and pull you back to a more neutral pelvic alignment. You're going to need strength, just like our previous question and answer, in your hip abductors, your hip external rotators, and it's got to be more than just the acute corrective. Yeah, glute bridges and hip abductions and external rotation exercises like clams are going to help, but what I find in people and with people in that kind of situation, it's a total body fix and it's a total program fix. So let's say when you go to perform a pull-through, you need to make sure you're really working hard to externally rotate, keeping your knees out, keeping foot, knee, hip in a solid alignment. When you squat, maybe squat to a box for a while again, so you have to externally rotate your hips, keep foot, knee, hip in a good alignment, and kind of work it from that angle, because we get people that have knock knees, and we know that's an issue both long-term as far as just joint wear and tear, as well as short term, because you're more likely, if you play any sports, to suffer from, you know, meniscal issues, ACL tears, MCL tears, that sort of thing. So it's a total body fix. Don't keep beating your head against the wall with the internal rotation mobility. Instead, work on the lower ab strength, getting the hip abductors and external rotators stronger, and that should not only fix your internal and external rotation, but it should also help with your alignment as well. John, what do you think?
I love having you on. I don't even have to, like, we should just have you on every week, and then I can just be like, oh, the FitCast with John Fast, and then I can just go do something, because you answer every freaking question like exactly what I was said.
Yes.
I absolutely 100% agree that it's most likely already internally rotating. That's exactly what you would expect. I think the best cues that I try to give is just to spread the floor, which is a common enough cue anyway. And I always look at these things exactly as not only the strength issue, but it's the neuromuscular strength issue, because what's likely to be an internal rotation on the hip that's been there, it's not only a matter of strengthening those muscles, but learning what it feels like to be in proper alignment. So it's a matter of doing those exercises and then understanding what it feels like when you do those exercises. Exercise in and of itself helps, and there's evidence to actually show that. We had, I think, couple episodes ago, we were brought up some of that research, which I thought was amazing. But you do still have to be aware of, okay, this is what proper alignment feels like, and this is what proper, you know, activity in the muscle and positioning. And then you just have to check yourself all over the place, because you're going to find that you're falling back into your known patterns, because that's what you know. It's like saying, oh, you're signing your name wrong. You should be signing it this way. You know, like you can do any exercise you want and you'll get stronger and be able to sign your name more quickly. But unless you actually take the time to work on changing the signature, you're just going to sign it naturally whenever you get the chance. And that's sort of what happens here. So exactly right. And that's what I think the idea did, you know, of knock knees and exercises for knock knees. It if there's a structural issue there that causes this valgus moment, then that's what it is. That's structural. That can't be changed. But if there are contributions from muscle, from neuromuscular, you know, and proprioceptive positioning, then exercise absolutely can help. Most of the time, it's a combination of the two. So you do your best to correct what you can, and then sort of, you know, deal with what you can't. But that's everybody. Everyone has some kind. No one is aligned perfectly. So you do your best to either undo some of that or to at least help it along, so that you're not completely reliant on like a joint, and you're still using muscle as best to your ability.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Kevin, you back? Is Kevin back? Kevin's not back.
I'm back. I'm right here.
All
right. I'm here the whole time. I was actually listening, John. Sorry. I want to kind of jump off the jump away from the outline real quick and ask Mike, you know, this is another thing that a lot of people are talking about, and that's the use of the Vibram shoes. Are you a believer yet?
To some extent, yeah. You know, here's what I always come back to, and I talk about this a little bit in the single leg presentation, but when we think about it, there are multiple ways our body gets feedback from the ground and or for the way our body gets feedback in general. And, you know, three of the most important ways I feel, especially when we're talking single leg stance or movement, are the foot or the stability you get from your foot, the feedback you get from the ground, your hip stability as a whole, and your pelvic stability. So we can look at these three pieces of that equation, and I think too often, again, we get so focused on one thing. Like these barefoot people would tell you that, you know, barefoot training cures world hunger and cancer and everything else.
Right.
You know, you just strap on your Vibrams, you go for a run, and everything's perfect. I wouldn't go that far, but I do agree with the fact that I think the shoes that we've worn, you know, since we were little kids, have probably led to some serious dysfunctions throughout our body. I always liken it to if you guys have ever had a TV with a soft mute button, you know, you hit the soft mute and it goes kind of quiet, but you can still hear it. That's kind of what shoes do to the feedback our feet should get from the ground. Instead of getting a strong signal when the TV is up at full volume, you put shoes on, it kind of mutes the feedback that your body gets, and so it's kind of forced to guess a little bit more. Or it could even be getting bad feedback depending on the shoes that you have on. So I'm doing a lot more training myself barefoot. If you come into our gym, a lot of our clients are either training barefoot in Vibram, something along those lines, just to try and get better feedback, to get better foot stability, so that we know we have that kind of cleaned up. Now, you know, again, foot stability is only part of the equation. You need to have a stable hip. You need to have a stable pelvis to keep your hip stable. But it's one part of the equation. It's something that I think more people could probably benefit from. So, long answer, but hopefully that helps you out a little bit.
Well, that's I mean, not to kind of cheat, but that's the reason why I wanted to ask you that is because I just love the concept of the mute button. You know, for some reason, I think, especially, you know, I kind of looked around when you said that, and like a lot of people wrote that down. You know, because it just makes. It's one of those things that just helps it make a lot make things make more sense for people.
Yeah. I always try and find easy analogies because, yeah, you know, how many of our clients, none of our clients really care. Well, a couple of them care, but they don't care why things work. You know, if you can give them an analogy like that, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then they're more likely to do it. Whereas if I just say, yeah, just do this, then, you know, it just doesn't work the same way. So if you can give them some sort of analogy to kind of, you know, help them understand why they're doing things, you tend to get better compliance. So,
yeah, no, that's a great point. I've been finding that out, that people don't care how much you know; they just want to make sure it works.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's go to the next question that we have in the outline, and that is from. Oh, it's a great question. It's from Kevin S., not me. I have a question with. Proliferation of corrective exercise information via the net in products such as Assessing Correct and Magnificent Mobility. How important is it for trainers to respect their space, their scope of practice, and that of other health professionals? And sorry, that's from Mark, not from Kevin S. I read too far down.
No, you're fine. So, you know, here's another thing that I tend to get a little bit worked up about. I'm going to do my best not to rant on the topic. But I think people want this like clearly defined line in the sand that says a personal trainer or a strength coach's job stops here and the physical therapist's job starts here. And they're on opposite sides of that line. And I think, I mean, just listening to me and Fast Talk, and granted, we know each other and we've hung out and we have similar kind of vantage points, but I love the fact that he's a PT and I want to learn from him. Because I feel like the more stuff I learn from him, the more he learns from me, the better mm-hmm. the entire process is. It's a continuum. It's not – training is training. You know, that yes, there is a time when somebody blows an ACL and they go through rehab. He's absolutely a better person to train that client than I am. But over time, you know, as their training goes from rehab-based training to training again, you know, there's definite gray area. At what point is he better than I am? What point am I better than he is? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, the better we understand each other's job, the better overlap there is, the better the entire training process is for the end user. And that's what really irks me when people say, oh, well, he thinks he's a PT. Man, I'm not smart enough to be a PT. I'm not a Bill Hartman or a John Fass or, you know, Gray Cook, any of these guys, and I don't claim to be. But I want to understand what they do, because I feel like the better I understand their job, the better training my client's going to get from start to finish. And so I'm kind of in a unique situation because I am paired up with Bill at iFast, and we get people that are in, you know, for lack of a better term, rehab type mode. But at the same time, you know, I'm not charging insurance. I'm not doing that sort of thing. They come to us because we get results. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about. I mean, we've had people, and again, I'm not trying to bash PTs or anybody else, but we get a lot of people that got poor therapy at some point in time or poor rehab, and they've come to us because they know we can help them out. So at the end of the day, I don't really care what people think of me as far as how I do things or what I do. The bottom line is, if I get somebody results, then I feel like I've done my job. And, you know, I think Fass would tend to agree with me. I'd love to hear his opinion on it, because he is. At the end of the day, he's a PT, and I'm more of what you would call a strength coach or personal trainer. But, you know, there's definite overlap there, and trying to draw a line in the sand and say, my job stops here and the PT's job starts here, it just doesn't work like that. But Fass, what do you think, man?
Yeah, first I'd like to point out that it was Bill Hartman, John Fass, Gray Cook.
Yeah.
That's what the quote was, yeah. Friggin' world domination. absolutely, and I think that's exactly right. I mean, there are technically, yes, there are legal standards. There are definitions legally of what is physical therapy and what is not, and who is licensed or legally allowed to practice that. But even that wording, if you look at the legalese, is a little bit, you know, there are certain things, it's like, you know, you can't do mobilizations or you can't whatever. Right. But, you know, there is other than that, absolutely. And I've always sort of looked at that, and I think you're going to love this one, because it's my issue with leg extensions, all right? Leg extensions, you know, and I read this, I think it was in a magazine, Men's Fitness, where some personal trainer was like, you know, leg extensions are bad for you. They're good in rehab, but they're bad for you otherwise. And I looked at it and I'm like, really? I'm like, so what part, when do you become rehab?
Right.
Like, I mean, granted, I completely respect the idea of, like, you know, if I'm strong and I'm muscle balanced, leg extensions I may not choose to include that into my training. But what part am I injured? What part am I in rehab? And what part am I just have some pain? Because if you just have a little pain, the evidence suggests that leg extensions are exceptionally helpful. So how do you decide that? And I think it's a continuum. It's exactly right. That. So, you know, if you put us on paper, absolutely. Both of us have been personal trainers. Both of us have worked with athletes. Both of us have worked with rehab people. But you're absolutely right. If you want to be, like, you know, a powerlifter, high level athlete, don't come to me. Go to Mike Robertson. That's his bread and butter. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, and I think that both of us coexist in this kind of sphere, but there is a lot of muddy area. I think that the way that I kind of separate it is, if it is a true, you know, if there's true injury where you visited, you know, you feel like you need to visit a medical professional, that's somewhere where probably the personal trainer shouldn't exist unless they're working in conjunction with that, right, that medical professional. I know many physical therapists that refer out to personal trainers, and they have, like, they're like a stable almost of personal trainers that they trust and use for, like, you know, either a continuation of rehab once the, you know, the technical rehab is over with, or even in conjunction, like, okay, you're going to come here for their manual stuff, but once or twice a week I want you visiting this person. And I think that's totally cool. That makes a lot of sense to me. Also, as a personal trainer, you do have to be cautious of the idea that you do put yourself in a legal risk if you're doing too much. So you have to ask yourself, am I qualified and capable of doing this? And not just because you think you are, but because you've been trained and educated to do so. And that's and you know, even things like the NASM corrective exercise stuff, I think that's a really good step in the right direction. But sometimes you get guys that think that, okay, now they're physical therapists. And it shouldn't be. In my world, in my mind, the personal trainer should be the guy or the girl that that keeps an individual healthy, that solves, you know, muscle imbalance based pains or little, you know, little aches, pains here and there, nothing that interrupts an individual's life. You know, like, yeah. Oh, maybe it hurts my knee when I sit down, but I can do everything that I want. So possibly you don't need to see a physical therapist for that. However, if that pain continues or gets worse, then maybe that's time when you refer out because you don't know enough or you're not, or there's something a little bit deeper that you're not qualified to handle. The physical therapist then takes over when there are impairments that affect your activities of daily living. So if I have a shoulder problem and all of a sudden I'm having a lot of trouble, you know, washing my hair in the shower with this arm because, God, it just hurts too much, then that's possibly the area of the physical therapist, and maybe a personal trainer should not be involved there because that's actually affecting the individual's day-to-day life. So that's kind of how I separate it. But again, that doesn't mean that personal trainers couldn't say, well, dude, you know, you've got weakness of your lower traps here, and a couple weeks later they're fine.
Right.
You know, a personal trainer, I think, is fully capable of making those basic strength assessments. But anything beyond that, you know, joint integrity or joint mobility, range of motion to some extent, because personal trainers aren't really trained in what is normal versus abnormal range of motion most of the time. But things that are a little bit more involved anatomically, biomechanically, that may be something that personal trainers should kind of step away from. But I think if you are a personal trainer out there, the question you should ask is, am I, you know, it's do no harm. That's right. That's the medical reference, do no harm. So if you fear that there may be, you may do harm unintentionally, but that you may not help this individual, that I think you're better off siding on the air of caution and saying, you know what, let me refer to you to a physical therapist that I know.
Right. Just to follow up a few quick things, I guess my line's in the sand, like where I would say I'm not qualified to help this person. If they need any kind of modality, that's definitely not me. If they need soft tissue work, that's not in my realm. Joint mobilization, not in my realm. If let's say they literally just had surgery or something like that, that's not for me to deal with. But think about, if we want to think about just that whole entire training continuum, if you have a healthy athlete, you know, obviously that's kind of in my realm, but let's say they tweak their back or they tweak their shoulder. You know, maybe that's something where it's just a factor of better programming and better coaching. That's something you can probably handle, but it all comes down to what are you comfortable with? And I think, you know, a PT, that's their bread and butter, you know, so you just have to know and understand, look, this is what I'm comfortable with. This is what I'm not comfortable with. This is what I'm trained to do. This is what I'm not trained to do. And at the end of the day, it's building a network. You know, building a network with a great PT, a great chiro, a great massage therapist, so that you don't have to be that jack of all trades. Because I know the best thing for me is when somebody gets injured, you're seeing Bill. And that's just the bottom line. You know, I want them to get that level of, you know, assessment and thought process so that they know I'm getting assessed by the best. And if he says, hey, this is something you can handle, then great. And if it's something where they need PT or they need specific soft tissue work, he or somebody else can take care of that. So don't feel like you have to be a jack of all trades. You know, we all have our scope of practice and what we're comfortable dealing with. But then for the rest of that kind of gray area, or, you know, that the black area that you're not credible or ready to deal with, go ahead and refer that out to somebody else. So yeah. Long answer, but hopefully that helps you out a little bit, Mark.
Yeah. And actually I was thinking about my last year in PT school was a really good example of this, because I was at the point where I was starting to, you know, cross over in a sense to the rehab world. My last year I was already full body ART certified. I was in, you know, like my last rotations, whatever. I mean, for in general, I was like, you know, 90% physical therapist. I just had to pass my boards. But there were still places that I would not go, even though I knew I probably could, because I wasn't licensed yet. I wasn't, you know, board certified physical therapist, and there was still, therefore, I was limited. And even though I thought that I knew everything, and I certainly didn't, and I certainly still don't, but even though I felt, you know, capable, I can help this individual, I said, what if I'm wrong? Yep. And that was really where I would draw the line, even though I was, you know, like, almost there, you know, but
right.
It still was something. Kevin, anything to add, or shall I take the last question from your doppelganger?
No, I think this is all awesome stuff. It's I'm loving listening in. Mike is like one of my fathers of, you know, I'm serious. You know, I've been in this only for about 4 years, and Mike is one of my fathers that I follow and I listen to everything he says. So,
Mike, you're so old.
Well, Mike, isn't that weird? You have a 24, like one of my 24-year-old son. It's not weird at all.
That's not weird at all, dude.
It happens.
Very mature for a 7-year-old. That was wrong. Go ahead.
That's about right.
By the way, with the Vibrams, and this is so freaking wrong because this whole situation makes me sick, but I did picture all the people cleaning up the Gulf in Vibram Five Fingers while you were talking about how it cures cancer.
Or Crocs.
Yeah.
Or Crocs, yeah.
Or Crocs.
Yeah. Mike, I've been having knee pain for about a year now. There was no apparent trauma that caused the pain initially, but it has persisted and made lower body exercise almost impossible. Walking up and down stairs aggravates my knee, as is walking, squatting, etc. I began working with a physical therapist about 2 months ago, and she wasn't able to tell immediately if it was due to muscle imbalances or a torn meniscus. Last week, my knee felt great, and we decided I would continue my rehab without her assistance. I did bodyweight reverse lunges on Wednesday last week, and my knee is still in pain. The pain is on the outside of my right knee. I can pinpoint the spot and apply pressure with my finger to trigger the pain. Mike, please provide any insight you can on what I should do to improve my knee health. I do not take any supplements, and I do a proper warm-up before every training session. Thanks for the awesome podcast. Feel free to eliminate whatever you deem unnecessary. Okay, I just did. Thanks, Kevin S.
Okay, the first thing I would be interested in is the person's age, because, and John, you might want to correct me here, like if somebody's older, they may not care as much if they have a meniscal injury, because, you know, these things happen a lot of times over time. But I would be really leery if you're younger and your PT thinks you may have a meniscal tear and they can't figure that out. Like, either I would want them to be assessed by somebody else, or I'd want to film, like an MRI or something. Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah, age, possibly. Usually it has more to do with activities of daily living, though. I mean, the standard, you know, generally standard is you go to see the surgeon, they say, they take some pictures, and they decide whether or not you need immediate surgery or not. But almost, you know, 99 out of 100 times you'll go to rehab first and try to deal with it. So it usually boils down to what are you still unable to do. But age might be a factor. But then again, age has more to do with what the surgeon does.
Right.
So, not necessarily.
Would you agree, though, that this person maybe needs to find a different PT if they're unwilling or unable to determine? You know, like that's kind of the beginning. You need a firm diagnosis. Do you have a torn meniscus or do you not?
Yeah, and, I mean, right. I mean, with respect to my colleague there, and, you know, we only have, you know, Kevin's word of what was going on. But honestly, like, you know, meniscus is, you do base it on impairments and what you find. There's no very good meniscus like testing. But honestly, the difference between a torn meniscus and muscle imbalance, meaning like probably like an anterior, you know, knee pain type of situation going, I mean, if you can't figure that out within the first couple sessions, you need to find a new physical therapist. Because, I mean, granted, I did my residency at the knee capital of the world. So, I mean, I would see this like every other day. But really, you should be able to figure it out within a few sessions. Okay, this is what this seems to be.
Right. So I'll give you kind of my viewpoint as somebody that's dealt with a lot of knees, and then, you know, always I'll kind of defer to Fast, especially since you're in pain. But some of the basic things I would be checking, if we're going joint by joint, I would check ankle and hip mobility, just to see kind of where you're at there. I'd be interested in your alignment. If you're in like an internally rotated type hip position, then, you know, you could have just kind of an irritation on that lateral side. I'd be interested in your tissue quality. On the outer portion of your thigh, it could have some sort of adhesion, maybe in VL, IT band. VL could be adhered to IT band. So there's all kinds of things on the outer portion of your thigh that could be causing that. And another big one is just hip weakness or hip instability. So again, it's amazing how many issues you can solve when you fix their hip abductors and their hip external rotators. I think it's either Ireland or Powers had research a couple years ago where people that had anterior knee pain or patellofemoral type pains were 26% weaker in hip abduction and 36% weaker in hip external rotation strength. So it's a huge red flag if you have a weak hip, chances are you're going to have either a knee issue, a lower back issue, something along those lines. So from my perspective, those are some of the basic things that I would address without seeing you, you know, move even just a squat and a lunge and some basic patterns. It's hard for me to give you a definitive answer, but those are some things just off the top of my head that I would be looking for to try and address, or, you know, at least diagnose. But bottom line is you need to find a PT that's going to give you a firm diagnosis so that way you can address whatever issues you have. So, John, what do you think, man?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it from the standpoint of let's actually talk about differential diagnosis of, you know, anterior patellofemoral pain versus like a meniscus. There are certain special tests, but they really lack, you know, quality. So the things like grind tests don't tell you too much. It can possibly indicate one thing versus another, but they're not quality tests. So you might do them as a therapist, but you have to put them aside and say, well, maybe, but I can't tell you for sure. What we generally do to differentiate, obviously, anterior knee pain is anterior knee pain. That is almost always some type of muscle imbalance issue, like an overactivity, or, you know, where a tendonitis type of thing of the quads. Evidence base shows that quad strengthening is enormous for a person that has this issue. Now, if that comes with certain movement, and it typically does, we look at it's called a movie theater sign, where if you're sitting for a long period of time and then you just go to stand up, you get that initial pain, or even you may start getting that pain just from sitting down for a while. Soft tissue can be very valuable there. Fixing hips and ankles, just like Mike said, is huge there, because it's not just about you do it from both sides. You say the quad is too weak to do what you're asking of it, so I'm going to make it stronger. And you're also saying I'm going to change the movement so the quad doesn't have to work as much in the first place. And you do both sides and you usually have very good results. Meniscal tears. The one thing that really perked my ears up was the fact that he said that he could put his finger on where the pain is. And it's not anterior. It's a little bit lateral. So that to me does kind of indicate that it's a possibility of meniscal damage. May not be something huge, but it's possible. There's still other structures there. It could be lateral collateral ligament. It could be, you know, even IT band type of stuff, because I don't know exactly where he's pointing, talking about. But usually what we do is we look for joint line sensitivity, because that's where the meniscus live, the two menisci. So you look for joint line sensitivity. It could be to the posterior. You get the posterior horn of the meniscus. You could, but it may also be to the front or to the sides. But like I said, there are some other things that live there, so you do have to sort of differentiate it further. Generally speaking, weighted activity is very painful, because that's where you're putting pressure on the meniscus, and it's weighted activity through range, because if you're, you know, that's the idea, is that there may be a little bit of sniff at what we call a bucket handle tear, for instance. Depending on what the injury is to the meniscus, you may actually catch it within the range of motion. So if you get a point where you're like, this is okay, ow, that's where it hurts, then that may be more indicative of something that's meniscus related. That's an e-diagnosis and an e-evaluation, so it's really not worth much, but at least it'll kind of, you know, hopefully say, you know what, some of this, some of this sounded like, yes, this is what I have, or no, absolutely not, that's not what it is. And then at least you can have a little bit more to possibly give the physical therapist, the next physical therapist, because again, we don't always have an immediate answer as soon as the person walks in the door, even after the first couple of times. But if you see that your interventions are working, you're starting to build on you should have a working diagnosis, even if it's not, you know, you're not 100% sure, you have to rule this out or you have to rule that out. Eventually, those things should be ruled out. Yeah. So if 2 months later, you felt good and then you did one movement and it bothered you again, well, either you didn't get to the problem, or the problem is actually your movement and that was never taken care of in the first place. So definitely agree 100%. Try to find a second opinion. And the fact that there were no pictures taken, you know, we don't base diagnosis on pictures.
Yep.
But at the same time, if clinically the evaluation indicates something and then you find that something, you have very good evidence to suggest that, yep, this is what it is. It works. It doesn't work in reverse when the physician takes an x-ray, you know, unless it's like a broken bone, for goodness sake. But you know, if the physician takes, you know, scans of your back, says, oh, you have a herniation, let's do surgery, those are the worst outcomes. But if you go, you know, and you have a physical evaluation, the evaluation is possible, disc herniation, then you take pictures, the disc herniation is right here, it's right at the level, your radicular symptoms are exactly what we would expect, then you may, in fact, have that problem. That may be the cause of the problem. So I'm just really surprised. It doesn't sound, by the way that the question was worded, that there was a lot of this type of stuff done, and it should have been.
Yeah. Always err on the side of good conservative therapy first. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my rule of thumb. If I can keep somebody out from under the knife, you know, because I know Eric's talked about, you know, whether it's knees, backs, shoulders, there are tons of times you're going to find torn structures, whether it's a labrum, a meniscus, or, you know, a disc bulge, and it's asymptomatic. Right. So, you know, don't let the pictures tell the story. Kind of, you know, work in the process or the order that John talked about, and then kind of go from there.
Right. Right. And especially if there's still, you know, if someone – now, it sounds like he got better and then it got worse again. If he was getting better, then maybe all this, you know, what we're criticizing wasn't even accurate, because we're saying, you know what? In 2 months, he got so good, they decided to basically discharge him from PT.
Right.
So
yeah,
then, you know, it's possible that it was going in the right direction, and then, you know, something happened. There's something wrong in the movement and the exercises that he's doing that screwed him up all over again. So all this may not be, you know, valuable, and the PT actually did a good job. But, you know, after 2 months, you should have some kind of relief of pain, or you should be going into further options possibly.
Right, right.
So.
All right. I think that's where we're going to end this.
That was easy, man.
For reals.
For reals.
Is it too early for That's What She Said? I just got a t-shirt that says That's What She Said on it.
That's awesome.
And how to do a Hadouken in Street Fighter. I just got a t-shirt that shows you how to do that too.
Oh,
for all the people that I destroy in Street Fighter.
That's valuable.
Hey guys, it's Future Kevin. I just want to say, here comes the awesome discussion that we have on regulating the fitness industry, stuff like that. And we kind of go in a bunch of different directions. We get in quite a bit of an argument. So hopefully it's going to be real thought-provoking, and we're going to get some great feedback from you guys this week. So here it is. We're going to be talking about it in just a second. So anyways, I'll edit that part out, and we'll put it in the off-topic discussion. But before we do wrap up, you know, Mike, again, you know, where can people check out your stuff? Can you, you know, tell them a little bit? This is basically the time to you know, plug stuff, but
yeah. Mike Robertson, rulestheworld.com.
Yeah, I don't think that's taken yet, but you know, tell people, like, if they don't know, like, what's the single leg solution all about? You know, is it just for trainers, or, you know, can my mom watch it and get something out of it?
Sure. First off, for like everything, Mike Robertson, robertsontrainingsystems.com. That's where I have my blog, my newsletter. You know, I've got, I don't even know what all's on there anymore, podcasts, video clips of exercises. There's just a ton of information, like literally over 100 articles that I've written over the years. So if you want to find out just more about me and what I do and kind of my thought process, that would be the place to go. As far as the single leg solution goes, I think one of the big misconceptions there is people assume, one, that it's just for trainers, which it's not. And two, I think they assume that because they can just go in the gym and do walking lunges, that they know how to do them properly. I think one of the best things about kind of this renaissance in movement that we've seen here lately is that people are focused on moving better, whether it's a squat, a deadlift, a kettlebell swing. You know, you got guys like Dave Tate who do entire seminars just on squatting, benching, and deadlifting. And I think we need that because we don't understand how to move well. We take for granted how a movement should look or should feel, and we just assume that because we can squat pain-free that we're doing it right. So that's kind of why I created the entire single leg product, not only to teach people how to split squat better or single leg RDL or, you know, single leg squat better, but to teach them kind of a progression. Because especially in big group settings or in boot camp settings, we see these people in day one, they've got a 300-pound overweight person doing walking lunges when they have really no business doing that. So one of the biggest benefits beyond the coaching of the exercises is all the progressions that you'll see, because I take you from day one, workout one, You can't even do a basic step up. This is where you start to, over the next, you know, X amount of weeks or X amount of years, you go from the 6-inch low box step up all the way to a single leg squat or a pistol. And I think that's something that's really valuable for people because, again, you don't just go in day one and start doing exercises that you saw on YouTube because they look cool. You do the exercises that you can do with appropriate technique that are going to give you improvements in your overall movement quality, and you kind of build from there. So I think it's a fantastic product. It's gotten great feedback. I think initially the sales were a little slow. I didn't do the best job of marketing it because people didn't know, you know, is it for the end user? Is it for trainers? Is it for coaches? Kind of as a general rule, if you perform single leg or split stance lifts in your workout, you're going to get some benefits out of it. So there's my sales pitch. Hopefully that helps.
No, I've been using a ton of the stuff with my clients, you know, especially, you know, some of the things that are in there that you might not think about, like the, you know, using a band that you can throw just around a rack to make, you know, lunges a little bit easier for people. Like that's, you know, it can be pretty big. It can make it worth every penny. But for people out there that might still be doing single leg squats on a, you know, a Smith machine and or a leg press, and may need something that's a little bit fresher and getting them on the right track, it's definitely worth checking out. I can't recommend it more highly. And I actually got it sitting right in front of me, and it's great. Great book. It comes with a book and a DVD. We got a question about that too. Does it just come with a DVD or is it just a book? Yeah. It's full deal.
Yeah, it's a DVD and a book, and the DVD is the progressions, the coaching. It actually shows a lot of times the compensation and how to correct it. If you're a trainer, you know, the things you need to be looking for and coaching with your clients. And then the value of the book is, well, one, you have all that stuff to take to the gym with you because there's pictures and descriptions of all the exercises. But there's also like a 30 or 40 page written like theory or kind of lecture type section where I talk about the pros and cons of single leg versus double leg lifts and vice versa, where you'd want to program each, as well as, you know, specific programming examples. So if you're working with athletes, how you might want to set it up. If you're working with fat loss clients, how you might want to set it up. So just trying to give people a product that's very holistic in nature and that's going to give them, you know, a lot of the answers to the questions they may have about single leg training.
Well, John, do you have anything before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. And so here's my question, because this is more like a roundtable type of idea, but we did talk a while back about like a long time ago, like 6-8 months ago, we had a roundtable about continuing ed.
Yeah.
But more over like education in general. So I mean, Mike, you went through grad school, you know, right. So you've experienced the educations that we receive in exercise physiology, and we're talking a lot about, you know, you're big on education, read all the time, and learn, and you know, so. Now I make you the dean of exercise science for FitCast University.
Okay.
All right. How do we do this as an undergrad education? Because right now, I mean, it is, you know, you and I have had discussions about this. We talk about this on the FitCast, where what we think is right about the way that undergrads are trained, but also what we think is wrong. And then in general, taking a step back in the way that we see the field moving. Do undergrad educations in general, from what we know, it's not every, you know, specifics, but does it kind of walk into that realm of where we're headed as an industry? Is it going the wrong direction, or is the industry going the wrong direction and the education is right? So what do you think?
It's a good question. And, you know, I'm a little bit removed, you know, because I think it's been 8 years, 9 years since I was in my master's program and, you know, another two on top of that since I was in my undergrad. But I will tell you this, I did not learn one single thing about personal training in my undergrad education. Like if I would have walked out and gotten a job, it would have been solely based off of what I'd learned from muscle magazines. Now, could I have done an assessment as far as like some body comp goes? Sure. Could I have taken somebody's blood pressure and heart rate while they were on an exercise bike? Yeah. But, you know, how often? I think I've done exactly zero of those, you know, since I got out of undergrad. So I think what we need to see is almost something along the lines of either A, we really need to step up our game with regards to the undergrad as far as preparing people to train others, or we just need to make it where your undergrad is just your basics, your science, all the basic concepts, biomechanics, kinesiology, physiology, those basic things, and then you go on to a separate program where you learn more about coaching or training and that sort of thing. And that's where I think the real value is going to be. Maybe we need a 1 or 2 year degree where you come out and after you finish your undergrad, now you're going to personal trainer school or strength coach school or just, you know, something along those lines, because we're not getting that. And even in my master's program, you know, looking back, I learned a ton as far as, you know, again, kinesiology and biomechanics and how the body moves, but I still didn't get any real coaching as far as coaching goes. You know, that's something you almost have to learn on your own, and you have to go to Perform Better summits and big, you know, continuing education events. And maybe most importantly, you have to shadow other coaches. So, you know, I wish I had a great answer for you, but, you know, I think what I always tell people is I learned more in the first 6 months about coaching and training people as I did in any of the 6 years that I spent in undergrad or grad school. Just because I knew what my weaknesses were, what I needed to address, I got out there and I worked with a ton of people. And that may be, you know, kind of the direction we have to take things, but it's frustrating, you know, like you said, it's frustrating to see these people and they go to school and they get the education, but then, you know, how much real world experience do you have when you walk out with a diploma? And it's not very much. You just have to seek out good people that are trying to train people the way you think people should be trained and start your learning there. So, I don't know. It's frustrating, and I don't know the best way to solve the problem, but it is a problem, as I'm sure you've noticed.
Yeah. Well, how about internships? How about elected internships as undergrads?
Absolutely. I think that's what whet my appetite as far as coaching goes. I always knew I wanted to do something in the field. It wasn't until I did my internship at Ball State and working with the athletes there that I was like, dude, this is it. Like, this is what I'm passionate about, what I want to do. And the cool thing is, whether it's Cressy Performance or, you know, Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning or Indianapolis Fitness and Sports Training, I think they talk about your coaching tree. And the cool thing is I see my coaching tree growing semester by semester because we get interns in. And I view that as my job, as whatever you want to call me, a mentor or, you know, as an internship supervisor. But I think my job is to – I can't teach them everything in 3 months or 4 months, but I can at least kind of whet their appetite, get them curious and asking questions and kind of set their foundation as a coach. So I think any school where you don't have to do an internship, you might as well just not even bother. I mean, right. Honestly, you might as well not even bother, because we've got kids now where it's not even part of their graduation criteria, but they're coming to spend 3 or 4 months with us because they know how valuable it's going to be on the back end. But I think absolutely the internship is where it's got to start. And if you have the means or the funds, do multiple internships. We had a kid last summer who came in. His name was TJ, spent the whole summer with us, learned a ton. I know he's going to be a fantastic coach. He turned around this summer, and he's at Athletes Performance.
Mm.
So, I mean, tell me about, you know, having some great mentors. I mean, not to say I'm on par with Mark Verstegen, but, you know, you got guys like me and Bill who are going to give him a certain background, a certain foundation and mindset, and then you go and he gets to work with guys like Mark Verstegen, Nick Winkelman, all these guys out at Athletes Performance. Dude's going to have a great foundation when he comes out, you know?
Yeah.
So I think absolutely an internship is an integral part of kind of your coaching and training development. And if you're not doing an internship, you need to ask yourself why, because you just can't learn it all on your own. You cannot learn it all on your own. You got to have good mentors and people that are going to kind of groom you and teach you how the game works. So,
yeah, I think that, I mean, that's so valuable. I mean, I you know, Kevin and I have talked about this often too, but I mean, what Kevin did also, I mean, he goes to Cressy's, now he works for Mike Boyle, like, dude.
And MTV.
You know, I mean, and MTV.
MTV, yeah.
Right.
You know, you just can't replace that. I mean, I you know, through grad school, I worked – I worked with Bill and hung out with you. And, you know, and then afterwards, it's the same thing, exactly what you said. Could I have practiced? Absolutely. Did I feel like I really was ready to practice? Maybe, but probably not. And that's why I elected to go through residency training, because, I mean, right now, at least for physical therapists, it's still optional. And you just can't replace mentored training. The mentorship is just invaluable. And I always thought it was ironic that of all the personal training certifications, and which in some way I guess is kind of like their attempt to make a personal trainer, which of course we know is kind of not, but it is at least some type of pseudo attempt to say this is going to specialize you. But I always found it ironic that out of all the big names and the things that we hold value, the ACSM, the NSCA, these are top, you know, for whatever their faults are, these are the top. The one training certification that actually makes you spend time with another personal trainer is WITS. WITS, which is it's like World. Yeah, I actually took a trainer once. They were getting trained, and they asked me if I could mentor them. I'm like, yeah, okay. I mean, I've had people actually just ask me to do that just randomly, and I've done that. I love it. But yeah, they actually have as part of their certification process. Everything else is just like basically like this is what the ACSM says. I mean, it's not it's a minor certification, but the one thing that they do is that they make you go through. I think it was 6 weeks. With a personal trainer. Now, I mean, granted, it also comes down to who are you choosing to be your mentor. I mean, it could always just be the blind leading the blind. But, I mean, it just amazes me that no one else does that. Most undergraduate programs don't do that, to my knowledge. Have you go out and do some type of mentored training. Graduate programs, yes. And maybe like you said, maybe that's the right way. Maybe undergrad should be more of that base. And then grad school should be the that kind of like, you know, further training, and that's what it's designed for anyway. But, you know, then it does beg the question when you've got an industry that you don't even need a college degree in, you know, how do we get that around that problem? But, it surprises me that doesn't happen more, and it is a health field. Yeah. You know, it's part of that, just like we were talking before, it's part of the continuum. Why isn't it more serious?
Well, and you think about it, I mean, at the end of the day, and this is why I take like my job maybe too seriously. Some people would be like, man, this dude's kind of like stuffy about this. But like, I'm serious. Like, think about this, man. We could really either help people, but bad trainers or people that don't know what they're doing can really screw people up. You know, we're working with people's bodies. You know, it'd be like a brain surgeon that's never done a brain surgery before going in. I mean, maybe it's not on that level, but you know what I mean? Like, you could screw somebody up really bad if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't have an understanding of programming and coaching and, you know, what's appropriate and what's not. It's like, it just floors me that it's not a little bit stricter. It's not a little bit harder to get into. I mean, I'm with you, man. It's like, I see all ends of the spectrum because I spend a lot of time at seminars and working with people, and you know, so you see the good and the bad. But I don't know, it's crazy, and something I think over the years something has got to change. I just don't know what it's going to be or how it's going to happen. But you know, I just hope that you know more and more people are going to be tuned in to the fact that you know a piece of paper and a diploma aren't enough to make you a good trainer. You have to spend the time, you know, working with people. You have to spend the time doing internships, going to seminars. And that's more of a personal responsibility thing than anything else. I think people that are motivated and curious and genuinely want to help people, you know, that part's easy for them. They don't mind spending a weekend at a hotel in a conference because they know, you know, for the next 20, 30 years, their clients are going to get better results. But, you know, not everybody is self-motivated like that. So
do we license personal trainers? There's been talk about it. There's been state movements, you know, and we talked about it a long time ago. I don't even know what I said at that point, but I kind of think it's a good idea, but it's got to be worked out.
Right. Yeah, it's got to be worked out. And I always have an issue with like a state certifying something like that or the government's, you know, doing something like that. But I wish I had a great answer, man, and I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work. I would like to think that you're going to see this division, if you will, between the people that are really good and the people that are really bad. Because, I mean, think about our industry as a whole. How old is it? 20 years, yeah, maybe 20 30. Years.
Yeah.
You know, maybe.
Yeah, like Jack LaLanne, like, what, 75, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. 1980.
Yeah. But, I mean, as far as just, like, pure personal training type goes, you know, it's a very young industry. So I would like to think that there's going to be, over the next, say, 10 years, this natural separation between mm-hmm. the people that are really good, that get results, that know what they're doing, and the people that are just kind of, you know, making do. Maybe they're doing this as a part-time job or as a hobby. They're not serious about it. They're not doing the continuing education stuff necessary to be good at it. And so they'll just kind of fall off. You know, it's like business to some extent. Like if you run a great business and you do your thing, you stay in business. And if you suck, well, you go out of business.
Right.
You know, and so I'm hoping we're going to see something like that where we don't have to fall back on regulations and licensure and that sort of thing. But, you know, maybe that's what we need to some extent. I don't know.
I think the bigger problem is, and if you kind of look at the history of licensure, first of all, personal training and then strength coaching, and by extension, it's the only health care related provider that I can think of that isn't licensed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the only one. I mean, I can't think of anything else that isn't licensed and still has that kind of input on a person's well-being. But right. I think the other issue is that I think it really comes down to research, and unfortunately, I think it comes down to liability, because it's, you know, you were basically, you know, granted, you can drop your, you know, a weight on your chest, you know, God forbid, you can do, you know, stupid things like that that are very acute, and then you can say my trainer didn't protect me from it, but right. how do you draw, you know, how do you say the knee pain that I have that made me have to go get surgery was caused because my personal trainer was poor at their program design? Right. It's such a, you can't. I mean, yeah. you just can't prove that. And you may have certain cases where it's kind of obvious, but honestly, it is just really difficult.
John,
and even all the stuff that we talk about. Yeah, what's up, dude?
Well, I was just to say, every time you bring this up, that I think the big issue is, who the hell is going to say what's right and what's wrong in this, you know, policing?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now,
well, then what? I don't, it's just like a crappy, like a, I don't like this discussion because it's just frustrating.
It's not, because technically this should be evidence-based. I personally think the real problem is there's not enough evidence.
Yeah.
If you have an evidence-based regime, if you have things that say this is the way you do things and this is the way that you don't do things, you can construct a criteria for, you know, for entrance into a field.
So you think, you know, it should be government, basically government controlled, and just like the medical profession, I'm sorry, just like a, you know, a doctor, a personal yeah. trainer should have to be competent in all these
pass
fields.
Minimum, right.
But
pass
then
minimum requirement.
So many personal trainers out there are dumbasses. They'll never be able to do it. There will
That's
be no personal
point.
Trainers.
That's the point. Because is it? Because really what you're saying is it better
but
to have
that
a bunch
cripple
of unqualified
the industry?
People?
Yeah, but I'm saying, okay, let's
but
say.
But by that argument, every field that has been licensed would have gone through the same growing pain.
It's okay,
and quite frankly, there is such a concept as grandfathering in.
Okay,
there
John,
is a concept of grandfathering in.
If I'm going to cut you open with a knife, I think that is a bigger deal than if, you know, the situation puts out a workout DVD and is trying to help people, you know, get in the gym for an hour and a half, because that's what he does, and get his buys and his tries in, and maybe some abs. Like, I think it's a huge discrepancy. I mean, you're more on the rehab side of things where you deal with people with injuries. If it's just some guy that comes into a Boston sports club or something like that and is trying to lose weight, it's going to be how many times you see trainers that injure their clients. And if they do that, they aren't going to be in this field very long at all, because no one's going to want to train with them.
First
they won't
of all,
keep clients.
First of all, gym tan laundry. Secondly, really what you're describing, though, is if you think about it, like what I'm saying is there the link between poor exercise and injury? Because if there is, then that needs to be regulated so that we can remove poor exercise and therefore lower healthcare costs, improve quality of life. This is we're arguing
we,
right
don't,
now.
Don't we have this already with at least baseline certifications with like whether it be
we
ACE,
don't.
NASM, NSCA? You don't
we
think
don't, because there's no control over what they're doing. If I'm NASM, my
well, there's
you know,
a control
take,
over
the
what
materials
they know.
Are very, the materials are very different. The way that they educate, quote unquote, educate the trainers is very different. There's no standardization of what that quality actually is. Now, I agree with you,
but none of those certifications are
going
to teach someone to get no. None of those certifications teaches trainers, exercises or things to do that are going to cause them harm as long as they are currently healthy for the most part. Correct?
How do you know?
Okay, give me an example then.
I'm asking you, how do you know? If you don't have that evidence, then you don't know the answer. We don't know the answers, but we suspect that they're dumbass trainers. It was the same, you know, it's just what you said. You said a lot of trainers suck, and then you said, but no one's hurting anybody. Well, that either that makes sense, and therefore everything is overblown, and everything that, you know, we discuss here, what Mike and I just discussed, is irrelevant, or we have an idea of what it is, and therefore it does make a difference.
But is it a difference between getting people hurt and not getting people results?
I would hope so. I mean, I would hope so.
One of the issues you're always going to come back to, too, is licensure. And I totally just mangled the word. But it's really – sometimes you're going to have issues with people that work around it, too. For example, my wife's a licensed or registered dietitian, right? So she had to go through X amount of years of school. She had to do a 6-month internship, take a test, all that stuff to get those letters. But what you find here is, and again, because licensure is different in all these states, a lot of people here, if they're not dietitians, they call themselves nutritionists or sports nutritionists. So are they RDs? No, but they're acting like them. So, you know, it's kind of a deterrent, I guess, for some of these people, but there's always ways around it. And until you kind of educate the public to what the difference is between a nutritionist and a dietitian, you're always going to have, you know, issues there as well. So there's a lot of facets to the entire process.
And that even brings up a point, too, because then you and I both know, all three of us know people that are registered dietitians that scream and yell about the process. Yeah. How it's – the information is outdated. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of problems with it. My argument there is, well, at least there's a process, you know. But I agree completely with you that it's like, you know, that's legalese. I mean that's really more along the lines of like, you know, and technically there's not – as of right now, it's the same issue. You can be a nutritionist and you can in most states legally – advise an apparently healthy individual because they don't feel that, you know, if worst case scenario that someone gets poor nutritional advice, that this will lead to significant health problems. And it's about money, you know, I mean, it's about liability. Yeah. If someone is liable for causing significant harm and it happens enough, eventually there's going to be an industry set up or, you know, a board to set up to say, okay, these individuals should not have been acting this way in the first place. And now we've got to eliminate this potential harm. That's all money, you know, so it's the same thing. Like I'm saying, if we don't have the answers, we don't know if bad personal training leads to injury, leads to health issues, but we can certainly set up a theoretical construct where we say, okay, you know, bad exercise form eventually leads to, you know, meniscus tears, the shoulder injury, you know, all back injuries, all kinds of stuff, which we do know costs a ton in terms of healthcare. But at the same time, we don't have that line there, and we also know that there are so many other things that contribute. So is it really the bad personal training, or was it just everything else? You know, and bad personal training maybe had an impact, or maybe it didn't even. You know, the same thing, like if I'm trying to lose weight and a personal trainer isn't qualified to do that, is that a health risk? If it is, if this person develops type 2 diabetes, because then we know that exercise and good nutrition has – been indicated to help avoid that type of outcome. But can we therefore say you have to be licensed because you should have been able to help this person?
Is this not based
tough,
Sorry, go ahead, John. I'm just
trying I was just going to say, I mean, that I think is the problem. So we can complain about, you know, bad personal training, this and that. And I do believe, I mean, obviously I scream and yell about it. I think it's an issue, but how do we get to that issue? You know, how do we address that issue? And I think that there's not enough evidence to allow us to do it.
Does this not in part fall on the people's shoulders who are looking to get help? If I'm going to select a new doctor, do I just go to, you know, Dr. Nick from The Simpsons? Or do I go to, you know, do I go look and see like, oh, you know, who's recommended? Who are my friends seeing? You know, who's been, you know, doing this for, you know, 5, 10, 20 years and has a great track record? Or, you know, does that not kind of exist with personal training as well? I guess I've kind of seen it firsthand, but, you know, some people will literally come into the gym and they won't be able to tell one personal trainer from the other. But you think they would educate themselves to be able to do so because, you know, it is kind of a big deal. And, you know, it is someone taking your body and putting it in their own hands.
Well, I think that the difference is my response would be, and then I want to definitely hear what Mike would have to say, but one, I don't know about the medical field, but I know the research in physical therapy, and the fact of the matter is physical therapists, by majority and statistically significant, they are chosen, one, first and foremost, who's in your insurance providers, that's obvious.
Sure.
And then number two, who's the closest? People don't care. They want to know who the closest physical therapist is, and that's who they go to. It's convenience. Now, whether or not that's right or wrong, my argument would be that's perfect. That should be perfectly acceptable in a sense because it is assumed that, you know, there may be a difference between quality of physical therapy, but it's assumed that every physical therapist should be able to address your major complaints.
Okay, this is something completely different.
No, but it's not because if I'm seeking out a personal trainer, first of all, we all know the amount of misinformation out there. So to say, well, it's your fault because you chose a bad personal trainer, how does that person know they're a bad personal trainer?
That's what I'm saying. They should be able to at least have educated themselves enough to know that. They should be able to see how, you know, what sort
of – Mike went through an undergrad program and the best he knew to personally train is through Muscle and Fitness.
I know, but
I think that's real important because it's like, you know, how do you judge a good personal trainer from a bad one? The general population not only doesn't know because of misinformation, but I would argue they probably shouldn't have to know.
They probably should listen to the Fitcast.
Yeah, well, maybe. But, you know, where does it, you know, what's the point where you have to be an expert to choose an expert? That's not the point. I shouldn't have to know the medical field to be able to choose my physician. I should be able to look at the physicians and then, right, maybe say, okay, they've been practicing for a long time or whatever, but I should be able to very quickly and easily say, looks like a good doc, I'll give it a try, because it's assumed that physicians should be qualified and capable. And maybe we have, like, you know, the best, you know, knee specialist in the region and the best shoulder specialist and whatever.
That's what I'm talking about. That's why we have those guys. And that's – I'll use the example of plastic surgery. Do you just go to, like, any random plastic surgeon to mess with your body? Or do you go and see, okay, I'm going to – could be going online and seeing, you know, what fitness center around the area has the best track record. They have reviews online for everything now. And you can just make a simple Google search for best gym – like in Boston or best gyms in, you know, Indianapolis, and you should be able to get a good idea of, you know, where I should be looking for.
That's still the blind leading the blind. Name the most popular personal trainers in the country. It's the morons on Biggest Loser. And we've all said, you know, and Tracy Anderson. I mean, we've all screamed and yelled that they're unqualified. They don't know what they're talking about, whatever. Who is to say, you know, how, you know, if I read reviews, oh my God, people love their books. People love their whatever. So are these good reviews? Or is this something that I should base my opinion on? And if it doesn't work for me, was it my fault? You know? So it's, again, I don't believe that people, I do agree with you. Someone should have a basic understanding of who they're hiring. They should have a basic idea for, you know, this trainer is qualified or not, because certainly, you know, just because you've passed the test doesn't mean that you're good or great or whatever. But at the same time, does that mean that the best surgeon in the area is the only surgeon that should be practicing? And should I only go to this surgeon even though they're an hour away and no one else gets any work, meaning that the only the top 1% of all surgeons that are qualified surgeons are actually getting any business? That's not only unreasonable, it's impossible. There has to be a breakdown. Now, granted, if I have this very, you know, there are instances in certain, you know, bringing up the topic, there are instances in surgery where they're, you know, most surgeons have not seen this. It's very rare. And there are only a few specialists in the country. That's fine. But if I have, you know, the labral tear in my hip, I have to find the best one in and wait 4 months for them on a wait list? Or can I get the, you know, the guy in his group that's probably 99% as good? Or maybe even just the guy that trained under him that now lives 20, you know, miles closer. Is that guy not qualified? So that's the thing. Now, granted, big difference. It's a big difference from someone cutting you open versus someone who's a personal trainer. But by evidence base and by our knowledge, we don't really know what the difference is. We have no evidence to suggest that one is more dangerous than the other, you know, potentially. We don't know the answer.
Aren't you happy you joined us on this Sunday morning, Mike?
Yeah, this is intense discussion.
Yeah, here. But this is just frustrating more than anything, John. John, now I'm going to be in a bad mood because I'm going to think, oh, damn it, the state of the industry still sucks. But when I go to Perform Better seminars, I see the light. I see people getting better, and I see people that are actually going out there, and they're learning, and they're
That's what we have to focus on, Kevin. If you focus on like the bottom 20%, yeah, you're going to be miserable. And that's any field, because there, trust me, there's a bottom 20% in every field, right?
Yeah.
So you got to focus on what can you do to elevate your game? What can you do to help industry or to elevate the industry's game? You know, whether it's going to seminars, listening to podcasts, all that stuff. All you can do is control your portion of the universe or whatever you want to think. You know, and that's kind of what I try and do. Like, look, I'm only one person. Can I do a lot now? I mean, think about leverage now versus 10 years ago with the internet and Facebook and, you know, podcasts and computers and all the things we can do. We can leverage, you know, ourselves so much more than we could 10 years ago. Side of it. Like, if you just think, oh my God, the industry sucks. I watched this horrible trainer at Boston Sports Club and they were doing, you know, crunches on the ab machine, you know, then yeah, you're going to be miserable. But at the same time, if you really focus on yourself, the people, your portion of the universe, and who you can elevate, you know, there will be a time of reckoning somewhere down the line where the really good are going to get separated from the really bad. And the people that are either, you know, really good or on the upper portion of that continuum or that curve are going to be the ones that, you know, are training the most people. And, you know, it will come, you know, but you got to continuously work to differentiate yourself and the people you're in contact with. But, I mean, if you focus on the negative, yeah, you're going to be miserable. So don't do that.
John, do you have any?
I don't really care about the answer. I just wanted some feedback because the last three podcasts, like, don't have any feedback, so
yeah.
Well, this is why we do. Actually, you know what? Before we record the podcast itself, we do have a new segment called, you know, appropriately, listener feedback. So if people do have feedback on the subject, the best possible way to do it is to send us a voicemail. Send it to, let's see, what is the phone number? 775-45-FITCAST, or you can send it to 978-633-3488. And like I said, you have a couple chances to make that message perfect. You can always delete it if you don't like it and then start over again. And we'll play back a bunch of those next week. So let's see what you guys have to say. And, you know, well, again, maybe we'll discuss it again next week and kind of go off what you guys had to say.
Perfect.
Excuse me. All right. John, are you satisfied?
Yes, sir. I'm always happy.
Okay. All right. Well, wow, that was a great interview. Thank you, Mike, so much for
My pleasure,
coming back on the show. That was a blast.
My pleasure, man. You know, I'm more than willing anytime you need me. So just let me know.
Well, in case John ever ends up getting lost or
yes,
dying, you are the
wow
next to the throne. John, you know what? We got to move on sometimes, all right?
Wow.
Yeah, maybe on your world tour.
I'm gonna be flying, and then you say something like that.
Maybe I'll ask you about your pictures next week, John.
I don't want you to.
I know you're gonna be pissed.
Listeners,
if I don't.
Just go Facebook me. Don't bother with Kevin.
Go Facebook me.
I'm not even selling anything. I just want the popularity points.
There you go. All right, I gotta eat something. I'm starving.
Yeah, I gotta go.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Send in your feedback. Do it.
Do it. Wait, do you have that Street Fighter game in your house now? Is that the game that you bought?
Mike, I got this thing that has this arcade machine. I have 1,300 games in it. I have every Street Fighter, every Mortal Kombat, every arcade game you could ever
think of.
Dude. I swear to God.
How much did it cost? Can I ask?
After all is said and done, I kind of refurbished it. I put in a nice 21-inch computer monitor, like an old-ass CRT, which I got for free. Thank you, Craigslist. The components itself, it's kind of like a modified computer. That cost me about $500. Plus, I put in new controls, which cost me about $40. And just a lot of time on the weekend. But
wow. Really worth it.
Dude, I'm totally telling you, like, being able to play any Street Fighter, I don't know, like, Pac-Man, I could go play that right now, play anything.
Dude, I don't know, you may have to just delete all this stuff, but I'm totally interested now. So,
this is off topic now.
How did you get all 1,300 games? that work?
Well, they sell this thing, basically there's this thing called JAMA, which... It's kind of like the harnessing that they use for a lot of arcade games. So basically all that's in there is it's really a PC that's running Windows 2000 Chinese edition and a hard drive with all like the ROMs of the games on it. And it literally like boots up. It looks like it's going to Windows 2000, but then just a list of games pop up, like 1,300 games that I organized some into special, folders and stuff like that, or special lists. But, no, dude, it is.
I so want that, dude.
You
don't even understand. I want that.
Oh, Mike,
in my basement.
It's an easy project. I mean, you can look on Craigslist. You find an old arcade machine. You're gonna take out the monitor most of the time, anyways, because they usually are pretty crappy by this point.
Right.
And all you have to do is I built a shelf inside it to hold the 21-inch Sony VGA monitor that I put in there, and I'll shoot a video of it, and I'll kind of show you what I've been meaning to do. That I keep getting emails from people when I mentioned it like a couple months ago that people wanted to see what it looked like, but I'll shoot post a video of it online, and I'll kind of show you how it works.
Came together.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty. It's kind of like a little boy's dream.
Now, I'm going to tell you, dude, I used to be pretty badass at Street Fighter.
Yeah?
Back in the day when I was like 12.
Well, it's got everything. It's got Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter 2 Turbo. It's got all the Street Fighter 3 edition that has Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo. It has all Mortal Kombat 1, 2, 3, Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. It's got everything.
I would never get out of my basement.
Never.
No, it gets, I mean, it's good. Like when Roger Lawson comes over, we basically, it's like Street Fighter all night. All night. It's really bad.
Raj Law.
Raj Law.